The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Well, hello, Zero Books viewers and readers. It's another episode of the Zero Books podcast, or Zero Squared. I have Ben Burgess. You can see his name in the corner if you're watching this on YouTube. On with me today. We're going to be talking about his book that's coming out. When is that coming out, Ben?
It's coming out in the spring, but it's available for pre-order now. Yeah,
Canceling Comedians While the World Burns. We're also going to talk in a second hour for patrons only about socialism, the path to socialism, whether or not a Menshevik like Burgess is ever going to be anything other than someone who I'll have to protect after the revolution. No, seriously, we're going to just talk about the transition program or workers' co-ops or some sort of realistic prospect for developing socialism in the second hour. It should be more heated. Also, in the second hour, I try to talk trash about contemporary leftists. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, tune in the second hour. On Patreon, become a Patreon supporter. So I pushed that right away, right off the bat.
Nice.
But Ben,
I'm still trying to figure out how to seamlessly work that into what I do.
Well, I don't bother about the seams.
I feel like you would defend me in that scenario.
I would. No, absolutely. I would.
I feel like Varn, it's kind of 50-50 whether he's
No. Convicts. That's wrong. He's 100% put you up against the wall and shoot you. But I'm like 75% on your side. Ben, I want to start actually by really actually thanking you for coming back on the podcast. I know that, you know, you always have a home here. You're always welcome. You say you'll always come back, but lately you've been starting your own channel and you've been getting a lot of big names, on your own podcast and video stream. And maybe we could start before we dive into questions about your book, just on you talking about what made you decide you wanted to try to compete with me and go off on
well,
your
that
own.
Was the main, that was the main idea, was to compete with you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, right.
If possible, I would like to drive you out of business, although that would be complicated because then my livelihood depends in part on you.
Yeah, it's a weird situation. But actually, are you still the co-host with Adam Proctor over at the Dead Pundit Society as well?
I am. We're taking a little break right now, but I am. And also Brianna Last is the other co-host there.
Mm-hmm.
We've done some good episodes there. We had a nice interview with Adolf Reed, I don't know, time blurs together in quarantine, but not that many weeks ago, where we Adam and Brianna asked him like real substantive theoretical questions, and I asked him if he liked The Sopranos.
Yeah, that's good.
You should check it out. Get this out. But anyway, to answer the part of your question about deciding to do this in the first place, honestly, a big part of that was that after Michael's death, I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, plans for the future and what I could do or should be doing right now. Just kind of trying to embody that Michael Brooks spirit of constant hustle and starting new things and, you know, finding new projects.
I think that I don't know what Michael would want us to do, you know. But I figure probably he would just be so pissed that he was gone so early that he wouldn't give a fuck what we did. But at least that's how I would feel. I think if I could look down on us from heaven and I was him. But I think nonetheless, the best way to pay tribute to him and the best way to respond is to push on making the kind of content he would make, fighting the kinds of fights that he would fight, and developing the ideas that he was working on developing as best we can.
Yeah.
So I commend you there, and I think that's the right response. Okay, so but you we were talking about Chrisman, and I wanted to use that as a segue. Now it's not so natural.
Sorry. Anyway.
That was my fault, though. But okay, in a recent live stream, Matt Chrisman claimed that politics and arts have combined, that like a lot of what we seek out and think of as our politics is really just an aesthetic experience that we're having online for the most part. And that rather than creating institutions of working class power, because we don't see a way to do that, say it's not there for us already. There's no institutions for us to funnel our energy into for radical change. We are reduced to seeking these, I don't know, like dopamine hits combined with daydreams. And we seek out art that expresses how we feel and confirms what we already think. Do you think that that is a good explanation of the one of the problems on the left? And maybe does it fit into the cancel culture?
Yeah. I mean, yes, on both counts. I think it is. I think what Matt is getting at there does tie into a significant part of the problem. I guess that could mean two things, right? So one is the idea that art has merged with politics in the sense that there's been this weird hyper-politicization of art, which is certainly true, right? I mean, that's what inspires the, that's like the example, you know, my book is about the pathologies of the left. And the particular example of that I picked as the striking example for the title was precisely about the sort of weird over-politicization of art in that instance, comedy, right? You know, but I mean, it applies generally. And then the other issue is about sort of treating politics itself almost as an aesthetic experience. And I also think there's something there.
Yeah. Now, you're a short story writer,
mm-hmm.
And a picture. I don't know if you've written novels or not.
I wrote a novel. It's unpublished. It's like that, you know, whatever. I mean, I always think of the Mad Men when Roger Sterling says that, you know, every executive in this building probably has the first two chapters of a novel in his desk.
You have a complete novel somewhere, yeah. But you've published short fiction.
Finished it, but yeah.
Yeah, you published short fiction in genre magazines. I mean, that's how we know each other, really, is because mm-hmm. we were both in that circle for a while. And we both came up at a time, I think, in the genre of science fiction, where political science fiction of a certain left-leaning type was, if not dominant, then at least on the rise. And there was, I felt that what drove my own writing was the desire to express my politics or my political dissatisfaction to some degree mm-hmm. or another. I think your own writing was of a similar type.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, were we contributing to the blending of politics and art that Chrisman was decrying and denouncing or is there another way to conceive of political mm-hmm. art?
Yeah, I mean, so I think we weren't, right? And the reason I think we weren't isn't because I'm like terribly attached to defending the honor of short stories that I was writing 10 years ago, right? Like that's not something, you know, I think without false modesty, right? That's not something I'm super emotionally invested in.
Mm-hmm.
But because the issue isn't that political art exists, because it's always existed, right? Like, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. that you're probably not going to have, or maybe you will, right? But I think it's probably helpful to have political art as part of political movements. It's certainly very hard to imagine the history of the labor movement or like the liberation struggle in Ireland, for example, without extremely political folk music that accompanied those things. And again, I mean, I think there's a role for that, right? You know, that like that every, you know, every cause, you know, needs its marching songs, and like, and I think fiction, you know, like good fiction, right? The best fiction, right? People, fiction by people who are like much better fiction writers than I am, right? Like, expresses whatever the particular preoccupations and obsessions the writer has. And sometimes those can be about like, you know, drugs or religion, you know, like a lot of Philip K. Dick, or they can be about like, you know, sex and cultural changes like Philip Roth, right. You know, or they can be about politics like both of those guys actually. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, a ton of my other favorite writers, and that's totally fine. Right. Like, I think that's a perfectly reasonable way of like thinking out loud about mm-hmm. about politics is to mix it with what you're doing on a literary level. So I think that the thing that's the thing, and you know, whatever. I mean, you know, Ernest Hemingway wrote some super political novels. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is troubling as a trend is not so much the fact that fiction or other kinds of art exist that express political preoccupations, but that people approach fiction and other kinds of art in this super political way from the other end, right? You know, that like that so much of so many people's relationship to these things has become so political in a way that kind of reflects what I was talking about in a article that I wrote for Arc Digital Media called Overdosing on Symbolism, right? You know, where my claim is that the fact that so many people are spending so much of their time right now very invested in the pettiest possible symbolic battles is both a symptom of and a contributing factor to the lack of a left with any kind of real world power, right? Like so in other words, I think the thing that was, I don't think it caused anything necessarily, right? You know, but I think that the thing that was an early symptom of the problem wouldn't so much be any fiction you were writing or I was writing or, you know, I don't know, Ken McLeod maybe, right? Like that might be my favorite living science fiction writer who writes super political fiction, right? That like, but it's not that any of the stuff we were writing was very political. It was Race Fail. Which was for anybody who's not familiar with it, that, which, you know, whatever.
Why would you be?
Right.
Was a decade or more ago, and it was took place on a defunct social media site, LiveJournal.
Yeah. Right. That's yes, largely yeah.
And yeah. Back in those days, when I had like 300 people following me on LiveJournal, I was like a big shot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, 300 people was a lot. Now it's of course it's nothing.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So this is, so it's like a decade ago. Yeah. More than a decade ago, but a little over a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Basically this like extremely small community of like, you know, even if you're like super into science fiction, there's like a 2% chance that, you know, what we're talking about, this of, you know, like genre writers, especially younger ones, and, you know, maybe some super fan.
At the time, you and I both counted as younger. I mean, I barely did, but.
Yeah, I was like 28 or something, but yeah. Yeah, and it was, I think I've joked a couple times recently about how when I go back and rewatch Entourage, which is a show from that era, I identify a lot more strongly than I ever used to with Vince's older brother Johnny Drama, who he's carrying along with him in his Hollywood career, you know. But you know, and he's always trying to tell, you know, the other guys about the glory days.
Right,
but
right.
This was not glory days stuff, right? This was like weird and embarrassing. That there was this really extended thing that was largely devoted, I think even putting it as charitably as possible, to people doing close readings of works of fiction to decide, to as a way of evaluating the progressivism of various authors, primarily on racial issues, hence Race Fail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an overly charitable way of putting it, because it may have started with one post that did that, but it quickly became about misreading or, I would just say misreading everybody's posts. It was more about responding to a response to a response to a response than it was about the initial argument. Just about everybody who was anybody in the world of sci-fi publishing either got canceled, even though no one was using the term, or got victimized by someone who should be canceled.
Right. Like, and actually, that's a really revealing incident, right? Because this is exactly the kind of shit that happens 20 times a day in 2020. That you get these weird interactions where, even though it's like five times removed from whatever the original thing was, right? You know, that people are examining a response to a response to a response to a response and interpreted it in the worst possible light. And I think a big part of the problem, actually, just to skip ahead, right, is that, you know, especially God, I mean, LiveJournal, Jesus, at least people were writing like posts that could be like 600 words or something on LiveJournal.
Yeah.
In Twitter, it's 280 characters. And it really, so there's not a lot of time to say anything very nuanced. And also, like, just the structure of it. And you did have a little bit of this even then, right? You know, with LiveJournal, with Race Fail, but especially something like Twitter, it does exist now, really rewards making these kinds of snap judgments, because it's a good way to like get a lot of quick validation and approval, and which I think is a lot of what was going on there, right? And really, like, especially like the way I remember talking to this with some people who are in my at this time I was actually committed enough to writing fiction that I got an MFA, and at my MFA program, you know, guy I was talking about with there, right, you know, that like from the way people talk about this, you would expect that, like, you know, some of these people, right, you know, involved in the discussion were in the Klan or something. Really, it was all people who basically shared the same moral and political commitments, right? I mean, like, mm-hmm. practically everybody involved in that was like basically a lib, right? You know, that you know, like a few weird leftists in one periphery, a few weird libertarians in another periphery, but basically, right, you know, like mm-hmm. like everybody involved in there was some kind of lib. And, you know, so it was this extended exercise in people who basically had the same normative commitments, like trying to look at each other to see if they really had those commitments or not. Or if like they were saying something or had written something in their fiction or had said something in a LiveJournal post about a LiveJournal post about a LiveJournal post about something somebody had written in their fiction mm-hmm. that reflected not thinking that. And really, in retrospect, I mean, I could remember, right, you know, just do a little self-criticism here, that some of this struck me as pretty weird at the time, but like, but some things that some people involved in this would say, I think sounded superficially reasonable to me then, but like a lot of really basic questions that just didn't occur to me when I was in my late 20s, when I was reading some of this, right, like have occurred to me since, right? Like people would say things like, oh, you shouldn't treat, you know, racism as being a binary thing. It comes in degrees. And because like, if you live in a racist society, it can like rub off on you. And so, you know, you shouldn't take it as a moral condemnation, you know, it should just be like, I'll get a little something on your nose, right? You wipe it off. Right. And I agree with some of that.
Right? Yeah. I don't know about it. I don't think it's like having something on your nose.
I don't think it is either. And I think if you actually look at the way they acted, they clearly didn't think so either, right?
Right, right.
The way people talked about this when they denounced people was not absolutely not like they had a little something on their nose, right? It was like they were an enemy of the human race. And and that's something, by the way, I see to this day, right? Like this is something that in 2020, you see all the time this like tension between people who, when they're talking in the abstract about the issue, they're talking in the abstract about what they're doing. It's like, yeah, like, you know, people got certain things wrong, or, you know, they're whatever, like they talk about these very demoralized ways, right? But then when they're actually in the thick of it, they talk about in hyper-moralized ways, right? You know, that right. like you're a bad person for doing this. And of course, another thing that I, even though again, like that characterization that I just gave, I would still agree with parts of that, right? But like, but another thing that I wish had occurred to me more at the time was, well, okay, but how, like, are all judgments of something being racist just like correct by definition, right? Is anybody ever wrong about that? If they are wrong about that, are you allowed to argue with it? Like,
that was the answer to that was no. I mean, yes, they're always correct, and if they're made by a person of color,
right? And frankly, a lot of times, even if not,
right, or one of their spokespeople,
right,
right, a particular kind of spokesperson. And no, you're not allowed to argue against that. And to do so is an act of racism in and of itself. And that was what the premises were, which were made explicit. I mean, that wasn't like my interpretation. That was basically said, like, white people need to shut up and listen, you know, rather than think that you can argue with logic, why don't you just learn? That kind of, that kind of thing was being said. And all of it was about the interpretation of a, I forget the woman's name, but a young adult novel or a science fiction novel that had done all right and had a black character in it. And somebody was questioning the way that character was treated in the novel. So all of it should have been handled through the publications and through publication in fanzines and literary zines of right. criticism and conversation about a book as literary criticism. Well, but that, it wasn't, because it was all about, I mean, what came out of that was a changing of a guard eventually at CEFWA, mm-hmm. a whole new crew of people taking over kind of the core of a dying industry, and you know, and a whole new kind of elite group of science fiction writers, although elite is probably the wrong yeah. term, because none of them are making a living.
Something that like hardly anybody right. actually makes a living
right. off. I mean, right. I've never been around when I tried to get into the realm of science fiction, and I did get in. I mean, I published novels. I might publish another one. But when I was working to make my way and get published in the genre, and I would go to these conventions and especially talk to people online, it was really, there was never more of I've never encountered more backbiting people, including myself, than I did then. It was a really nasty environment overall, and everyone was striving like crazy, because there was a sense that at one point you could be a writer of fiction and make a living in genre. And that was all drying up. No one really thought you could become a literary writer of fiction and make a living unless you were born into it.
Right.
But for average people, you could still make a living as a writer of fiction in the genre in the early 90s. And by the two, you know, 0 years, that was all drying up. But we all thought, well, maybe we can hustle our way.
Yeah. And so much of what, and I mean, I think the reason this is worth lingering on for a minute is that like a lot of this is like a weirdly, like exact microcosm of a lot of what we're dealing with now in the larger culture, right?
That yeah. Now it's happening at the New York Times.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, yeah, right. And like a lot of and you know, whatever. I mean, who knows, right? Like I'm 40 and much grumpier, you know, than I was then, right? You know, but all, you know, like I think still, right, even now, right, like they, you know, very often, right, the kind of people who are like the successful strivers and all this were people who I'd be much more likely to, you know, like, right, you know, because they were people who were, you know,
closer, they're talented.
Yeah, yeah, very talented, closer to my age, closer to some of my political preoccupations sometimes, right, you know, that, and you know, but the way that all of this in retrospect was being fought over, like the stakes are like nothing, right? Like there's a, it's
who's really going to be part of the voluntarily produced CEFWA journal. Who's going to be in charge of that? Exactly. No one wants to read, by the way, including the people outraged about the cover. No one wants to read it.
Nobody's going to read that damn thing, right? Like, that's the thing, right? You know, it's like, this is like some hobos arguing about like which particular boxcar, right? You know, because this is like by the mid 2000s, genre fiction had like gotten to the point where like what was still being called out of like custom and nostalgia prorate for like a short story. You could write one of those. You could get a pro publication once a month, which nobody did.
You couldn't get a pro publication once a month unless you were, Robert Silverberg or someone.
Right. And like, even if you did, that would not be a very big contribution to like an income you could actually live on. Right?
You might be able to pay for a studio apartment from that, just for your rent, I'm probably overestimating it. Was it like $600 for a short story in a major magazine, or was it more like $200 back then?
I mean, maybe it was all about the rate per word, right? I will say, right, like just to make this real concrete, right, that like during this time period, or a little bit after, right, 2013, so like kind of really at the tail end of when I was still doing this, I got a publication at Tor.com, which is like the best.
Yeah, 20 cents a word or 10 cents a word, something like that.
Yeah, whatever it is, right?
Or was it a dollar a word?
No, it wasn't a dollar a word. I think it might have been like a quarter a word, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, that's great. That's good money.
This stuff, that's very good money. I mean,
top flight.
This is literally the best paying magazine for science fiction short stories. And, that exists right now. I had a 4,000 word short story published there in 2013. And I think that like amounted to like $1,000 or something, which don't get me wrong, I was extremely happy to get, but also if I had somehow magically gotten a short story in Tor every month, right, rather than this being a
you couldn't have lived off of it. No way.
The crown accomplishment of 7 years of scraping.
Right. Oh, every month, there's no way anyone could get published in Tor.
Nobody could ever get it put in Tor every month. But even if you had, that'd be $12,000 a year.
Oh, I know, right. So, but that's a base. And then you do a lot of other writing and, basically what we're doing is what everyone in the genre had to do, right? You had to
it every which way. But it's also like the thing that's worth highlighting here, right, is that if you were really dedicated to this, you could like really scrape and strive and like climb the ladder and like you'd like you could maybe replicate the income of like a graduate student.
Yeah. You could end up like Jeff Vandermeer or that's the only one that comes to mind. just Scalzi, I guess.
I remember at the time, even when I was most optimistic, right, about my future doing this, I remember at the time figuring out, and I kind of pitched this to a bunch of people, and they would come up with some exceptions and whatever. So this isn't an absolute thing, but I think this still holds up, and I'm sure it's gotten worse, right? That everybody I could think of who I'd ever met, right, who was a so-called full-time writer. And granted, right, like, obviously, I'm not friends with Stephen King, whatever, right? Like, there are people who really, really do nothing but that, right? And they make a good living. But that's, like, the not even the 1%, right? That's, like, the 0.01%. Mm. So, like, everybody I'd ever met, right, who was a so-called full-time writer was in one of a couple of categories. Either one, really all they did for a living was write fiction. And that brought in some chunk of the family income, but basically they were married to someone with a real job. Two, they had a day job, but it was a day job teaching writing, right? And so that was like their real source of income. Or three, they had a day job that was really pretty disconnected from their fiction writing, but it could in some sense be described as writing. So the combination, they could say I'm a full-time writer.
Right, right.
All right, this is a much deeper dive into this than I was thinking we were going
to
do, but like,
no, this is like, we need to talk about this because we're both like, in the genre, or we're in the genre, or I don't want to quite give up on the idea that I'm a science fiction writer.
Actually, I think something we have in common is, if I'm not mistaken, right, both of us went to Clarion West, which is a 6-week summer writing workshop in Seattle.
I didn't know that about it. I'd forgotten it.
Yep. No, in 2006, I went to Clarion West. So
it's like we're part of the same secret society or something.
Right. And whatever, right. I mean, like I love doing that. And it was very, in fact, I think actually probably like it's part of the story of my like burnout with the whole thing, because I think when I first started writing, I had a lot of things that could superficially be seen as like successes, like, oh, I got into, I got this workshop, right? The other thing. And then, so it made me really, really think, all right, right. I tried to be realistic about what the track was, right. But like I'm on track, and then like, but also like, whatever, right. Like I wrote a couple of stories that people really liked early on, but like also, I hadn't been writing for very long. It takes a very long time to like get to the point where you're actually good at doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think like by the time like I had like that tour story, like I'd spent so long like bashing my head against, the wall of this that that like I it just didn't mean as much to me, right? Like at that point, because I'd sort of had to accept that like, okay, this is, I have to be, I can't be thinking of my life primarily in these terms.
Right. When I was in my early 20s, man, getting a short story published in any of the magazines that I read and enjoyed, or even some that I didn't give a shit about, but I knew of, right. It was more than just something I wanted. It was like why I was on Earth. It would confirm, confirm who I was.
Look, I ended up majoring in philosophy as an undergrad because, like, just like trial and error, it's like what I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I went to graduate school because, like, I didn't know what the hell to do with my life, and like this was like a way that I could like keep doing this thing that I like doing for a while and get paid for it. And but then like when I started writing fiction, right, early in grad school, right, like that was what I really cared about, right? Like that meant something to me, very much along the lines of what you were just saying, right? I was just interested enough, right, in what I was doing academically to like get through, right, and I always enjoyed teaching and whatever, but like, what I actually should have been doing, which was, like for the sake of my career, right, which was writing academic papers, I wasn't doing it at all, right, because
right.
All of my emotional investment and interest, was in writing fiction.
Did you listen to Ansel Nagel on the conservative podcast, Chris Buskirk's podcast?
No, I have not, right? Like I was just gonna, anyway, whatever. I was just gonna say,
She talks about a couple of theories that have been floating around. I guess this guy Michael Lind, who I'm not really that familiar with, has been gaining some popularity on both the right and the left lately. And there's some other theorists who've writing about social unrest. And the theory is that there's been an overproduction of elites, that there's been too much investment into higher education, and too many people then are educated and aiming themselves at professional jobs. And that has led to this woke culture, has led to a pseudo left response that's really just a disintegration of social norms and things like that. I mean, I'm not fully versed in this particular theory, but when we're talking about our own lives, it's hard not for me not to think about Angela Nagel. Some in, like in the back of my mind, I guess she's my superego now. Part of it, she's integrated into that. She's sitting there going, "Yeah, you know, you knock me, but listen to you. You are exactly the leftist I'm talking about." Yeah,
look, don't get it twisted. I'm definitely like in all of the forms of my adult life, right? I mean, I've always been some version of a PMC striver, right? Like
Right.
I want to be.
But that's not how I thought about it. I was like wanting to be a writer. I didn't want to be Elizabeth Warren. I wanted to be Charles Bukowski or Philip K. Dick, you know, or maybe Michael Hemingson.
I mean, you know, two out of the three of those are some of my favorite writers, but
right.
But of course, like in a weird way, Bukowski. Both of those guys actually, right? Like, these are people whose fiction has meant a lot to me, and poetry too. And Bukowski, although Bukowski poetry is basically just fictions broken up, you know, line, right? You know, but both of those guys, I mean, certainly in terms of their life, right? I mean, like those were certainly. Like strivers who like spent like an enormous amount of time, like, you know, submitting and getting rejected and agonizing about it. And, you know, like,
and Philip K. Dick was the kind of person who couldn't hold down a clerk's job at a record store.
You know, I think that there's like this sort of false equation, right? You know, between being realistic about like being honest about what your class position is in the society and like how this fits into these larger critiques, which is important, right? And I hope we get back to, but also like, but not equating that with like being a grifter or something, right? You know, because it's like nobody's, you know, like, well, actually both of the things, right, we've been talking about, right? Nobody is like producing like left-wing political content because like they were under any delusion that it was like the best way to make money. And
true, but it is a better way to make money than writing
fiction. Really, just writing science fiction.
Right, and the thing about science fiction and writing are some people are doing it and making a living, but very few. But the thing about what I was thinking was that the narcissistic impulse for and the need for recognition from a public, from an anonymous public, is in the background.
I think that's
both of us, and that it's also what drives when you talk about the media class in general and their need for woke reassurance. It is what's driving that as well, that narcissistic need for recognition in the public. And it's not, and when you look and see it in yourself and see that it's actually what's driven you to, and I have to say, like, trying to write fiction has been it's meaningful.
No,
It was meaningful for you. I think you should return to it, by the way.
Yeah. Actually, as we're talking, it occurred to me for the first time, not that I necessarily want to do this, but it's like, I could send that novel to you.
And, you could.
And that would be you know, probably.
And then we'd have to turn it into a TV series and put it up on the Zero Books channel.
And the funny thing about this is if I did that, right?
Yeah.
Then like probably as many people would actually end up reading it as would have if my dream at the time had come through and like some like literary publisher had like picked it up and put it out. And it's not like they would have made this like a high priority seller anyway, right?
You might have sold 500 copies.
Yeah,
1,000 copies.
Right, you know? Right. Probably more people would actually buy it if I'd done that, which is hilarious thinking about it.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week, and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.